This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing Sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
Yak! All right, welcome back. This is episode number 2 of the Until the Whistle podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Myers. Again, here I have with me Jeff Ketchum. We're going to dive into the second episode of this thing.
What'd you think of the, first of all, did you listen to your podcast?
I listened back to it. What was difficult for me about listening back to it is, one, I just hate how I sound. But then two, I listen to podcasts sped up. So I listen at them at like a 2x speed.
Yeah.
So when I was listening to myself just at regular speed, I felt like I was talking slow, but I think it was probably at a pretty good pace. But I got some pretty good feedback on it. So I'm hoping that, you know, I can make things a little more interactive as it goes, get some more input from people about what it is they want to hear. But I really liked hearing it. I think it was, you know, it was put together really well. And so definitely thank the folks at the Yak for giving us this platform to do it.
I think the coolest things about it for me were that, A, for a guy doing his first podcast, nobody thought he sounded like a guy doing his first podcast, yeah. Which I think would give hope to a guy getting started. Like,
yeah,
okay,
definitely.
I'm going to get better. And if the baseline low is it's pretty good, then like I can work with that. And then the other thing is like it was good enough that to stave off the mutiny on orangebloods.com over this whole idea of just like this new kind of content. It's like, what can we do to make, I think, everybody happy to kind of see what kind of content that we're going to be able to create on this? And so we threw them the bone of your podcast from a week ago. Like, we thought it was good enough that a week later it was like, yes, technically it's a wee bit outdated.
Right.
But there's a lot of good stuff that was in there that is absolutely relevant this week. It's not like the ills. Most of the stuff that we'll talk about with Texas football this week was on the table a week ago.
Sure,
Tulsa
was.
Didn't fix that.
No, unfortunately, it didn't. Speaking of which,
how are your app chats this week?
Man, it's kind of like, I feel like all my teams, right? So I'm a Cowboys fan too, and I feel like all my teams right now are just hard to root for. You know, like. It's kind of like my Cowboys group chat is pretty silent these days. And, this one, it was almost more disappointing than the Maryland game in some respects, because, you know, games like this, and I'll get to this in some stuff that I want to talk about a little bit later, but games like this, you know, when you play Tulsa, these are like your get right games, you know, it's when, and no disrespect to those programs, but they're the ones that you can kind of chalk up as the easy win. You can get your starters out of there relatively early, give everybody some playing time, roll up 300 some odd yards on the ground. You know, like you're supposed to be able to take those to the bank.
Like that can't get right, because if you haven't been getting it right.
Yeah.
You can get right in that type of game.
That's the thought anyways. Right. And Tulsa had other plans, or we had other plans, or a combination of both. And so, you know, I think, you know, kind of starting from the pregame atmosphere, I was pleasantly surprised. So I had a chance to go to this one as well. And I was pleasantly surprised at the turnout, especially with the Bevo Boulevard. I think that was a really good idea that new athletic director has implemented. And there was a really good turnout. My dad and I kind of walked through there. And it just seemed like there was a lot of people congregated there. And so that's something that, you know, Texas hasn't really had in the past, is one particular area where everyone can be. And then we kind of made our way even over to the part where the concert was being played. And, you know, I thought that was a really good look for the game, especially with it, you know, coming off of a loss and with the weather forecast, you know, saying it was supposed to be pretty gloomy and possible rain. There was still a really good turnout. And so you could really hear some of the fans there at the game. And that surprised me. I didn't think it was going to be as good of a turnout as it was. Still, you know, isn't filling the whole thing up or anything. But I took it as a sign that people are chomping at the bit for a winner, you know, that they're really looking for a program that they can support. And they're kind of putting their hope out there that, okay, you're going to give us a product that we can be proud of. And so people are showing up. They're still offering their support. I thought the student section was packed out pretty well. And
I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, actually. I haven't seen that since really back, you know, and I guess around the time I was playing to when Colt was kind of running the show.
I don't think I've ever seen the students all there at once that early, even back then.
Like, yeah.
They'd be there on time for the start of the game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But I think that was 30 minutes before kickoff, and that was the section of the stadium. I saw pictures of it, and I was like, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive. You know, it's like you said, we would still see them kind of trickling in the first quarter. You know, but
they were sitting previously. In the back,
yeah, as but, opposed to, but now they're right there, you know, kind of front and center to where they have. And I think it's first come, first serve. So they kind of have an incentive to get there because they can take advantage of better seating. So
that's what I'm saying. If you straggle in the first quarter, that's cool, but your butt's sitting in the back.
Yeah. Yeah. But then it was, you know, then the kickoff started again, even in the first half, man, like it's just, I can't figure this team out. I feel like we still don't really have an identity yet, and they're trying to find themselves and figure out what level of consistency they can maintain. Because I'll be honest, in the first half, you know, like I said, I expected to see much more dominance. And so when they got into the first half and started having some success, my dad and I left at halftime because we're thinking, okay, this is going to be another one of the kind of games you roll back. We can beat some of the traffic and get home and watch the rest of it. And lo and behold, you know, they just let them claw right back into this thing. And it was really interesting to hear Coach Herman's perspective of he was too hard on the guys at halftime. And he thought that was something to do with their
and
with
the
their
players
play.
Seemed to back that up. Like they said there were players who said we were impacted by whatever was said.
It's just
confusing.
So odd to me. I mean, it's like you're not really – I don't know what a coach could have said to me at halftime that would have
frozen in a game that you're in complete control of.
Yeah, I mean, you're at that point, what they hadn't scored, right? It was 21-0. So you're thinking, excuse me, that, you know, you're about to roll on to a pretty good victory. So, you know, the fact that they're – not on the same page gives me cause for concern, but then, I mean, at least in what he's saying, it's not just full on coach speak to some extent if they're backing that up. So
can I ask you a weird question?
Yeah.
I'm making this up. There would be people who it's my contention with Coach Herman that he's not ready to be the coach at a school like Texas, but that he has that in his locker that he could be a guy that could be successful at Texas, and it's about whether he's ready for this job. And I don't think he arrived ready. I think he was at Houston for 2 years, and I don't think Mack Brown was ready for Texas when he first got here. Like, he evolved.
Sure.
Even to the point where I think about your recruiting class, I always think of it as the last kind of wild, wild west recruiting class that he ever took because he took chances on guys.
Yeah.
They didn't pan out.
Oh, yeah. We had guys that never even made it to campus.
Half the class was five-star guys that never showed up. And you think about how good that class was, that the Adoree McCulloughs and the Robert Timmonses and the Marquise Johnsons and the
right.
I mean, the list kind of goes on and on and on. Even if you include guys like Mike Williams who showed up, Garnett Smith. Yep. Again, the list goes on and on and on. Did you sense that – because I think the hope has to be that Tom Herman does – figure it out, obviously, here, right? Did you feel like the Mack Brown that you saw in 2002, you first show up, excuse me, did you think that he had evolved? So that by 2005, it wasn't just the same Mack Brown and he got lucky because the right group of players came about and Vince Young does his, like, that part of what happened was the Mack Brown of 1999 wasn't the Mack Brown of 2002. And the 2002 guy that you saw when you first got here was – it became a better version over time. Do you feel like it was the same guy, or did you think that Mack evolved and got better while you were here?
I thought that he grew more comfortable in his role as the head coach. He was never the true X's and O's kind of head coach. You know, he was certainly more of your CEO type. but he became so comfortable within what it was that we were doing that he was able to be himself, allow us to be ourselves. And I think one of the more underrated things is really allow his coaches to coach. He, you know, we always had really highly sought after defensive coordinators. I mean, it got to be almost like a swinging gate, you know, of guys coming in, having success for a year or two, and then going and getting a head job somewhere. But he brought in really talented guys that were able to connect with us all, were able to share their vision for what we were doing. And so there was never a question about what that was. And, you know, we were all able to come together each time, you know, and really pull the thing out. So I do think he grew as a coach. I think he, you know, had to contend with that label of having some soft teams for a while there. And it, I think we discussed last week, it was kind of weird that we had that label, even with all the success we were having. But I think I kind of get where it was coming from, that still in some of those big games, we would kind of get pushed over. And that I think started to dwindle, you know, as he,
yes,
as he, moved on. Yeah. So
you guys did eventually put that whole,
yeah,
can't win the big one to bed.
I think so. I think it got to a point where, you know, we were having to look at 10 win seasons as not successful. And I think when you have that shows where you've grown in your program. Is, you know, we were winning, we were going 10-3. And I mean, I was looking at it my senior year when we won the Alamo Bowl. That wasn't really viewed as like a successful year, you know, at least not in our eyes and a lot of the fans' eyes, because we're coming off of a national championship. But again, I've said before, like, if we could go 10-3 right now,
that was a 10-3. You beat OU.
Yeah.
You know, the losses that year were, there's that the Nebraska game.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, there was some legitimate, yeah, highlight moments. The Ohio State game, which, uh-huh, you know, that was 1-2. Like, that wasn't just 10-3. That was 10-3 with some,
yeah,
stuff in there. And yeah, you're right. Like, that season ended, and it was like, that was a disappointment.
Yeah, and it was just kind of, it's kind of weird now, you know, when you look at how that is and you juxtapose it against what we're seeing now.
Oh, people go crazy for that season. Now.
I mean, I'm telling you that, like I said, that atmosphere at the Tulsa game was chomping at the bit for just something to cheer about. And I think as Coach Herman grows in this role, I don't know if people are willing to give him as much time as I think Coach Brown had. But you know, you're in a different time now.
Mac had Ricky though.
Yeah.
He came into
a bit different circumstance, but
they went like 8-5 and they had a parade.
Oh yeah.
The team.
Yeah. Yeah. That he was in.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's just different.
Yeah.
If Herman would have went 8-5 a year ago, there would have been no parade. They'd, yeah, have been, man, like, okay, solid.
Yeah. It's really tough. I can't peg this team. You know, I've heard you say it and I've said it amongst friends before, but it's just a weird team. And I don't know, you know, I don't think you could have gotten me to bet any amounts of money that we would have been a 7-point victor against Tulsa. But I mean, that was what it was. And so now you have, you know, USC coming in here. And you would hope that there's some kind of revenge on their minds. I mean, we're a little bit banged up with Keontae Ingram and some different guys, but then we should be getting some guys back as well. So, you know,
Coach Herman said literally 2 hours ago that Brandon Jones is going to play.
Which, okay,
I think that's good. A big one.
Yeah, because he's really been playing up to the level of what, you know, he was recruited to be. And I think he's really becoming one of those on the field leaders and a guy that, you know, could really be an impact player in every game each week. So, you know, if he's going to be back for sure, that's going to be a big boost. And I think they were really, you know, I don't know how much they let on, but at least some of what I've been able to gather from what they were sharing earlier in the year is that the freshman linebacker, what's his name? I don't know.
Call him Deli.
Yeah. Deli. We'll go with Deli. that they think very highly of him, you know, and to be pretty thin at the linebacker position and possibly getting him back Even though he's just a freshman, you know, that could be a big boon. But I think they may, you know, have a little bit more success against a traditional drop back passer. From what I've been able to see of Orlando's defenses, it seems like he's able to plan for those pretty well. And it, you know, eliminates a little bit of that run pass option that, you know, some of these other teams that we've struggled against have. But I really don't know what to expect. You know, I'm kind of hanging my hat on the fact that, you know, they have a true freshman that's coming off of just playing against Stanford and getting knocked around a little bit. And while I think he'll be really good down the road, I don't know if he's, you know, full on ready to make that leap just yet. But at the same time, I have no clue what team for Texas is going to show up. So,
two questions. What's the thing that worries you the most about just Texas going into this game?
The lack of consistency. I heard on the post game show, Jordan Shipley was referencing that a lot, and I couldn't agree with him more. Is, you know, the team will start out well, then there's kind of a lull in the middle somewhere, and then you kind of rally these last few minutes, and you'd like to think that they can just put together a solid performance for an entire four quarters. And I'd be hard pressed to think of a time in Coach Herman's era that they've done that. It might've been like San Jose or something, you know, where they actually put a complete game together. And even then I remember feeling at times like, okay, there's certain guys here streaking wide open. And if this was a better team, that could be a problem.
Right. You're right. There were a couple of those moments in that game.
Yeah. So it's hard for me to think of a consistent performance that they've put out there. And I can't really peg my finger on why. So I would say consistency is the thing that I'm worried about most, because when you play against teams that have a lot of talent, you can't really afford to have those kind of lulls, you know, in the game. And especially if you're up, you know, you really want to step on their throat and put it out of reach, you know, really put some serious cause for doubt. But the longer you let teams with talent linger around, I mean, let's face it, this isn't the Texas of old where, you know, rolling off the bus, people are kind of shaking in their boots. It's almost the opposite. You still get everybody's best shot, but they kind of are just looking to be able to pile on. It's not so much we're afraid of this team. It's that, you know, we can continue to make our name for ourselves if we beat, you know, Texas, because we still have a brand name. But the on field just hasn't matched up yet.
Question number two. So JT Daniels is a guy that everybody at USC thinks that eventually,
right,
this dude's going to be the guy, and he's their next great quarterback, starting as a true freshman.
Yeah.
I don't want to each week. Well, I won't be on it each week. So maybe the first two times I'm doing this with you, I'll throw Vince Young's name out there a couple of times. But yeah, you played with arguably the greatest quarterback in the history of the college game. So I think it's a fair question that you being in his recruiting class, you would remember what Vince looked like just early on, right? And I remember seeing him as a high school player and thinking he was the best high school player I think I've ever seen. But then I remember watching him in those first few practices, and balls were skipping in the flat. Like, it just was a different game for him, considering you played with that guy.
Yeah.
And I don't know that he was ready for week three of his freshman season to be what USC's asking JT Daniels to be. Like, what, from your experience, what is it that they're asking this true freshman to do in being the starting quarterback and come to an environment like DKR where there'll be 100,000 people? It'll be ready to go Saturday night.
Yeah.
And they're going to put the ball in his hands and say, we're going to win or lose based on how well this freshman quarterback plays.
Yeah, I think that's a good point for sure. You know, you have to realize, like, these are kids, man. Like, as into this as we get, you know, as much as we talk about it and scrutinize it, I mean, he's a freshman, so what, he's 18, 17 maybe?
You think, let me look it up. Make sure
you look 18. It up. But I mean, you know, he's a young guy still. And I think it's one of those things where you have to realize in high school, these guys are the cream of the crop. So a lot of what they're doing is on pure talent. You know,
you ready for this?
How old is he?
He's 20.
Really?
He's a 20-year-old freshman.
True freshman, 20-year-old.
He must have been, now that I hear that, I'm kind of reminded of like how he was groomed and.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a 20-year-old.
Okay, so maybe he's a little different than your typical freshman.
And he's 20 and a half.
Okay.
He was born in February.
All right.
He's almost a 21. By the end of his semester, he'll still be a freshman in school next semester in February.
But he'll be 21.
He'll be a 21-year-old freshman.
Wow. Okay. I mean, that's interesting. But I mean, if anything, that says maybe he's a little more mature than your typical freshman. But he still doesn't have the game experience.
He's almost old enough to drink.
Almost.
Almost.
But I don't know, man. I think it's just one of those deals where, like, early on, you got all these plays swirling around in your head. You got to be much more in tune to protections, much more in tune to where everybody on the field is. And that's just a lot. You know, that's a lot to take in. And then when you go into an environment you hadn't been in before and against guys that can actually hit you, you know, in practice, you can't touch the quarterback. You know, they can run by you and say boo and or yell sack or whatever. But it's a little bit different when you get in there and the live bullets are flying. So I think, they're going to be asking him probably more than anything to protect the football, I bet. So I would imagine they have a relatively conservative game plan of sorts. But, you know, it's tough to say. I mean, they believe in him. I've heard a lot of them compare him to what they felt Sam Darnold looked like when he first got there. You saw him the other night go out, and on his first pass, he throws a pick six, but then comes back and acquitted himself pretty well for the rest of the game against the Lions. So at least his first pick six was to a Longhorn alum in Quandre Diggs. But, he was able to settle in there and kind of right the ship. So, from everything I've heard, though, as well, he's extremely talented. And it's kind of going to be the latest in a long line of successful quarterbacks that they've had there. But I'm maybe too optimistically banking on, you know, some of his true freshman inexperience showing up in Austin Saturday night.
I don't want to put any words in your mouth. I'm going to try to ask this question in as diplomatic of a way as to not lead you into an answer. The team on Saturday that enters the game with a slight quarterback edge, if one even exists, is?
I'd have to say Texas, just because Sam has that experience. He's gone through some of it.
He played USC a year ago.
He played on the road a year ago in a tough environment and made some mistakes, but I think he also performed pretty well at different times as well. So I would have to lean Texas, but I'll be honest, it's kind of ever so slightly for me, because Sam still just makes these plays sometimes that just makes me say, like, what the were you thinking? You know, and I think a lot of it may have to do with some of that pressure we talked of, you know, of having to follow up, having to be the guy that is possibly considered, okay, are you the one that can really turn it around for us? Because we've had this lull of great quarterback play. And I would imagine there comes a good amount of pressure with that. And different guys handle that in different ways, or it shows up at different points in time of the game. And so it looks like, you know, he's a guy that tries really hard and wants to be great. But he still makes some plays that it just makes me wonder, is where was his head at when he made that particular play or particular throw? And so, to the same extent, I think it's really important for him to take care of the ball. I think he plays a lot more confident when he does. It seems kind of like, you know, you've heard the term sacks come in bunches. It sometimes seems like for him, his turnovers come in bunches. It's either like all or nothing, you know, so you're not going to get one from him at all, or you may have one or two, or you may have a pick and a fumble or something like that.
He's got some evil Tony Romo in him.
Yeah. Yeah. That guy that like you're scared of in the fourth quarter, because he's going to take a gamble on something and you're going to end up on the wrong side of it sometimes.
Well, so far he feels like a guy that is going to find himself involved in something noteworthy.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just hope you end up on the right side of that, but
because most of the noteworthy has been bad so far.
Yeah. And I think that's the toughest part about it is he was thrust into a situation again. And I don't know if we talked about this last week, but one of the things that I have to argue with some of my friends that are Longhorn fans as well is the one thing that a lot of these guys haven't had the benefit of is being able to redshirt. And I think, you know, even early Vince in his first few practices as a true freshman versus his first few practices as a redshirt freshman will tell you that that redshirt year paid off a great deal. Now, there was probably times where it was frustrating for him because he's used to, you know, playing at such a high level, but he was able to redshirt and so was Colt. So arguably two of the greatest quarterbacks in Texas football history both redshirted. Everybody that's followed them hasn't.
That's wild, isn't it?
So you haven't had anybody that's really had a chance to just kind of sit there and marinate in the position, learn it.
Think about if Chris had gotten a red shirt.
Yeah.
And had been able to come back.
Yeah, and I guarantee you, you know, he would have been able to see the game a lot differently. Now, his situation was a little more unique just in that his dad had played, so I think he was a little more groomed for it, but still, like, major red shirted. A lot of these guys that had a lot of success here,
James Brown redshirted.
They redshirted. And not just at the quarterback position, but at other positions as well. You know, I want to talk about the Hall of Honorees or the Hall of Honor guys that went into the hall this past Friday a little bit, but each of them redshirted.
Let's say Justin Blaylock redshirted.
Blaylock redshirted. Michael Griffin redshirted. Right. So it's just something about being able to stack enough talent to where you get to a point in your program where you're redshirting some of these guys, they're able to develop a little bit and you're not having to rely on something that on someone that is, what, 4 or 5 months fresh out of high school when they're showing up. I mean, as great as Keontae Ingram's looked, he just got here a month ago. You know, think about that. Like he literally just got here a month ago. Well,
then the problem with the program has been this entire decade is full of players that fill out this description, from Tyrone Swoops to whomever. Like, Sam, the needs of the program are what the needs of the program are. And there's a desperation that a year ago required Sam Ellinger to play because there was desperation at the position to have him play. And ultimately, this program will be winning games and competing for championships. And when that happens, is going to be the day when suddenly guys are going to start to be able to redshirt.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they're in this cycle where it's all hands on deck.
Yep.
And you know, the problem with that is even as you get into game 6 and 7, 8, all the way to the final game of the bowl game, maybe not so much the bowl game, right? Because they always say guys kind of have grown up as freshmen by that point. But that whole slate of schedule, I mean, you see a guy make a mistake, he's a freshman. Like, you're going to grow up. You know, Mac used to have this thing that he would say, and he stopped saying it. Yeah, but he used to tell this. He used to have this story that I think, like, I don't even want to say it. I think Joe Paterno told him.
It was Paterno.
I think Paterno told him this. And so, you know, it is what it is. Anytime now you tell Joe Paterno stories. But I think it was Paterno that told Mac Brown that for every set of freshman legs on the field on your team, that's a loss for your season.
Yep.
And so here Tom Herman is, and it's game one, and Caden Stearns is starting, and B.J. Foster's on the field. Yep. Keontae, you know what I mean? Like, almost at every position, you've got kids on the field. And, you know, I think that in a perfect world, the expectations of 8 years of a drought don't exist, and you can just watch these kids grow up and kind of enjoy it. But when you've been, like you said, the people at Bevo Boulevard are just thirsty. They just want to have a good team again, and they will give into it magnificently. But I think the first sign that it's not there, they get really frustrated really easy because the benefit of the doubt stuff has stopped.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the Hall of Honor guys.
Yeah, so the cool Hall stuff. Of Honor, man, it was pretty cool. You know, it's funny just reading some of this. I read over some of the guys that I knew, their bios and all the information. It led to, you know, some pretty interesting stats that I kind of just wanted to go over, but also just wanted to give them all a shout out for that accomplishment. So a number of players, you know, from different sports were inducted into the Hall of Honor class of 2018 this past Friday, of which I played with three of them. And then one of them was even our equipment manager, Chip Robertson, who's still there at Texas. And we all love Chip to death, man. He Coach Brown used to have this things where he would always say, as we were breaking down a couple times a week, Chip, what are we going to do to him? And Chip from Mississippi, so real country. And he would say, we're going to kick their ass. And everybody, that would rile everybody up. And more times than not, he was right. But so much deserved on his end. But you look at some of these guys that went into the Hall of Honor in this class, and Justin Blaylock, Derek Dockery. So you got two offensive linemen, and then Michael Griffin. Blaylock was a two-time All-American. He was, of course, a member of the national championship team, and then he played 8 years in the NFL. So, you know, he's part of that line of guys that were constantly being sent to the league there and, you know, really helped cement Texas's place in on the national landscape. But, you know, he was a four-year starter. So every year that he was, you know, playing, he redshirted, though.
He was good enough to, I think, start as a freshman.
Oh, yeah, he definitely could have. But we had enough there and enough older leadership
people
there.
People wanted him on the field.
Yeah, yeah, people were calling for it. And that was, again, at a time where we were winning 10 games a year. You know, so when you rolled in there, and he was a five-star. You know, he was Army All-American. So it wasn't like, you know, he was anything to sneeze at, but it's almost something, you know, he was really strong and I think strong enough to play, but that year off gave him time to build that up even more.
All those guys on that line redshirted.
Yeah. Lyle, yeah. So Lyle, Casey, Jonathan. Blaylock, Jonathan Scott had redshirted when he came in. So they all were able to be behind guys. But when you look at what he did, he had a UT record for consecutive starts of 51 in a row. Now, that's pretty nuts when you think about how many guys have rolled in and out of some of the different positions. But to have that kind of consistency and that type of leadership along your line.
That's a monster.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty insane. He was a two-time All-American, three-time first-team All-Big 12 pick. And then over his 4 years that he started, we were 44-7. So
what did you think the first time you met Justin
Bowen? Oh, I loved him, man. He was like a... It was funny because he's like, you hear those like big teddy bears, but he's the nicest guy.
He is.
Really, really, really smart. You know, he's in his time now, since he's no longer with the Falcons and he's retired. He's a co-founder of this like web community. And what it does is it's for teachers, coaches, and administrators to be able to network and find employment. So you always knew that he was going to be successful. I think business was even his minor. But when I first met him, man, I love his personality. He's just a really welcoming guy, but he was that guy that, you know, when he was on the field, he was just nasty. He was a mauler. And you knew that he was about his business. He didn't say a whole lot. I even remember that year that the Sports Illustrated regional cover came out and it was like either him and Lyle and Casey or something all on it, protecting VY, kind of like in a little huddle of sorts, and they were on that Sports Illustrated cover, and he just thought it was like the funniest thing, you know, because that's so far from him. He's not like a big limelight kind of guy, but to see him get honored, you know, for what he did here at the 40 Acres was really cool. But I did just, there was a couple of stats that I wanted to run through real quick. So in the 2005 and 2006 seasons, he was all Big 12, but in his senior year specifically, he was Big 12 Offensive Lineman of the Year. And that was, I think, like the first time they had started giving that award. But in that year, we rushed for 162 yards a game, which was 34th in the NCAA, had a total of 391 and a half yards a game, which was 23rd. And we scored right at 36 points a game. So that was seventh in the NCAA. Now, you think if we could get half of that now.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
People would be, you know, there'd be people in the streets dancing. But it just shows you that's 12 years, right? I mean, in 12 years time, how much has changed? I mean, I don't think we've been in that upper half in some of those categories since when Colt left.
It's been 12 years since Texas had a good offensive line.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's been tough. And
God,
then
that's incredible.
It's kind of mind blowing when you look at, I mean, when I was just reading through
it,
some of this stuff.
It hasn't been since your senior year.
It's been since my senior year where they put up numbers like that.
Well, they just had even when they went to the national championship game in 2009, that was just a serviceable line. I mean,
right.
There's Ndamukong Suh did what he did, yeah, in part because Colt was great. The skill guys were great. The line was just kind of good enough, just good enough to not get beat. I think that's what we've seen from this offensive line for the first two games of this season. It remains to be seen whether or not they can be serviceable against Oklahoma and right. TCU and USC this weekend. But 12 years, you were an active player with Justin Blaylock. The last time Texas, you looked at them and went, oh, their offensive line's going to kick our ass.
But then you look at the next guy, Derek Dockery. He was a guy that was there when we got here, right? So he was another first-team All-American. He played 10 years in the NFL, was a 3-year starter, 4-year letter winner. But he's a guy that when we were true freshmen, he was a senior. So he was a guy that Blaylock was looking to as, okay, this is the way it's done, you know? And you'd had some guys before him, Big Leonard, you know? So there was this, you know, kind of lineage of guys that you could turn to that had not only leadership, but the on-the-field chops. You know, D-Doc was a consensus first team All-American in 02 and first team All-Big 12 when we got here as true freshmen. So he was one of the guys that, you know, I talked about last week. We had that leadership at so many different spots to look to and see how this is done that was kind of all we knew. And that's one of the things that I think some of these guys haven't been blessed with is they've had to struggle with trying to figure this stuff out on the fly, trying to be a true freshman and starting against grown men. I mean, let's face it, that's what they are. And, you know, it's certainly a whole different jump when you get to the NFL, but that's something Connor's having to learn the hard way right now. When you're watching him with you know, playing guard for the Cowboys, he's out there getting pushed around, man. Like, I mean, I was watching him Kayvon Short from the Panthers. I mean, he was drilling him. Play
that
after
dude does
play.
That to everybody.
He does it to everyone.
But Connor got baptized.
But he was seeing him struggle similarly in the preseason games as well. Yeah. You know, and it's when you make that leap from high school to college. Okay, that's one jump, and then from college to the NFL. Certainly, that's another. But that's something that the most successful teams that we've had. Have had a number of guys along the offensive trenches and the defensive trenches that have been able to redshirt, build another year of strength, develop within the system, and then have guys that they could look to. So
I think Derek Dockery might be the most underrated player of that early Mac Brown era.
Yeah.
I think Leonard gets a lot of love and the linemen after that get a lot of love. But he really, you know, and he was on Mac's first true recruited class. He was that first number one class. I was just thinking about that. I'm going to feel stupid for asking this because C-Red's probably in the Hall of Honor, right?
I would guess so, but I don't know. I mean, so I looked up a little bit of what you have to do to be able to get in it. You have to have had 10 years pass from your last year of eligibility. So he's got to be in there.
I was trying to think of which guys from that recruiting class had been in.
I'm pretty sure he is. I'll double check that for the next show just to follow up on
Should
that.
Should Sims be in the Hall of Honor?
I personally think so. I think he had a tough rap just because of he was here at the same time as Major. But he accomplished a lot, and he accomplished a lot with a lot of pressure on his shoulder.
Am I allowed to ask which side of the Major Chris thing you were on all those years? Man. Like, is that too sensitive of a topic?
No, it's not. And I'll tell you why it's not for me. I didn't grow up a Longhorn fan. You know, if you remember, my dad, he played football for Texas Tech.
Yep.
So even though I was born and raised in Austin, I always rooted for Tech. I had neighbors that were Longhorns. We did the whole plant flags of the opposing team in your yard for whoever lost, that kind of thing. Oh yeah, we were into it. But and unfortunately, the first UT game I ever went to, I went with a friend, and it was them getting routed by UCLA.
Oof.
With Cade McNown and
no, everybody knows. You
don't have to say
that.
Yeah.
Everybody knows.
So okay, everybody remembers that. Yeah. So I didn't grow up a Longhorn fan, so I didn't really have any allegiances, and I didn't really start following them closely until I got recruited. I was always a Major guy, and that's just because I always liked the underdog. You know, he wasn't what people would consider your prototypical passer or anything like that, but he just found ways to get it done. And I always have had an appreciation for guys like that. I wasn't anti Chris. I just always leaned a little bit more to the late major side.
Fair enough.
So that's kind of where I used to land there.
There's still one more guy.
Yeah. So we had Michael Griffin. And so this kind of goes to how good some of the defenses that we had at the time were. He was a second team All-American, again, a member of the national championship, and probably arguably made one of the best plays of that game. In the interception that he had there, it almost seemed like it came out of nowhere. But he played in 50 career games, had 28 starts, and posted 364 tackles. And if I'm not mistaken, during the championship year, he led the team in tackles. So he had 124 tackles that year. One of the things that really impressed me is the way a lot of the DBs and just guys in general would always cut their teeth coming in was playing on special teams. And Mike had 8 block punts, which is a UT record. And if you just think about that, like, that's another thing that you kind of don't see as much with these teams as of recent. I don't know if that's because Coach Akina's gone. He's out at Stanford. I'd be curious to see what their standing nationally wise is in that area. But that was one of the things that we were known for is we used to block a lot of kicks, whether it was Brian Robinson on field goals or guys like Mike on punt return, or even Terrell Brown, Aaron Ross. I mean, all those guys, Cedric Griffin, that's where they got a lot of their starts, is on the punt return unit. And, you know, I think that just kind of goes to show the type of players we had. I mean, as a safety, Mike ranks 8th all time on UT's tackle list. Now,
he's a great player.
I mean, you know, again, he's another one that, you know, excuse me, had a lot of success.
Did you ever go to his house and play with his dogs?
No, I didn't really mess with his dogs. Now, I will say, and he'll probably remember this, at the time in high school or in college, I was dating a girl and I was going to get her a dog for her birthday. And Mike was the one that helped me find it. But I always avoided him. I'm not scared of dogs, but it just wasn't my thing. He had pits, and he would bring them out to practice when we would do 7-on-7. And I would kind of rub them in just so they knew, like, hey, I'm cool with you. But I would try to avoid them as much as I could.
My Michael Griffin story is my favorite one. Is I don't want to say that I discovered Michael Griffin, because that's not fair, right? But I was the first guy to rank him really highly. And Mike will tell this story, because when Mike first met me, I did an interview with him after he played a high school basketball game. So, you know, I kind of introduced myself to him afterwards, and I'm like, look, you know, I think you're a really good prospect, and yeah, I've got you rated really highly. And at the time, he didn't have any offers. He didn't really think of himself as anything. And so I'm coming up to him and he thinks like I've got an angle. Like, all he'll tell you that later on, and I'll get to the end of the story here in a second. Like, you know, I was telling him, I was flat out. I was like, I think you're a special talent. I don't know if I said it quite like that, but I've got a guy ranked in the top 10 in the state. That means I think you've got the ability to play on Sunday, basically, if I think that much of you. And I didn't know at the time, but he was really leery of me when he first met me.
Okay.
Like, he just thought, what's this dude's angle? What's he trying to sell me?
I can see that being Mike.
And I'll never forget. So 7-on-7 that year in College Station, he was sitting over there with a bunch of his high school teammates. And I want to say like an A&M coach or something like that, maybe illegally walked over.
Oh, man.
Because they always did that 7-on-7. They were hosting, so they had a way of being able to bump into guys.
Right.
The benefits of hosting. And I'll just remember when it was over with, Mike screams me down. He's like, hey, I just happened to be walking by. And he goes, and he was just like, hey, just so you know, I thought you were completely full of shit, but I'm acknowledging now that you were right. Like, kind of. He really thought that, like, he didn't think he was going to be big time.
Yeah.
I think he is just hoping, man, let me get a 4-year scholarship. You know, I'll go play somewhere.
Well, and at the time, there weren't a whole lot of guys that came out of Austin.
No.
You know, and so
he was AISD when AISD was.
Yeah, he was at Austin Bowie when they weren't a whole lot to sneeze at. And so, you know, between he and Marcus, his twin brother, I mean, they were kind of you know, some of that upper echelon of the talent in the area at the time, but
great family too. I'm glad to know all those guys, actually, you know, like I know their families. So to think that those families got to go back this weekend.
Oh yeah. And I mean, especially for Blaylock, like, you know, his parents and my, we were in the same recruiting class. So his mom and my mom were real close. His dad and my dad, they would always kind of, you know, cut up a little bit when they were traveling. And so it was cool to see them all get honored.
Who's the teammate that you had? Because it's been a while now. It's been, as we've just discussed, 12 seasons since you last played. Who's the teammate that you haven't seen in a long time?
Man.
That, if I let you think about it for just a second, that you hadn't seen in a long time, that if you could just go grab lunch and catch up with. Is there anybody that comes to mind that you just, you guys were boys in college and just, you know?
Honestly, Mike Williams. Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen him in forever. And our true freshman year, we were roommates. You know, in Jester, you had your own little suite where you get to share a bathroom. And so he was the guy that I shared a bathroom with as a true freshman. And I'd just be curious to see how he's doing. You know, his nickname was Freaky. I mean, that's what we called him. And I know they got a Michael Williams. He's not, is he there now or he's coming? The quarterback that was in high school. Mm-hmm. He was a quarterback in high school. And so, Mike was, I mean, he was an athletic freak. I mean, he literally.
Do you remember his high school recruiting film?
Oh my God. It was like, he was just out there punishing. It looked like he was like hitting people like, you know, 8 years younger than him.
And he looked like Terrell Owens on offense.
Yeah,
like
they used to throw him screens and he would take them the distance. So I'd love to see what he's up to.
So we have to track him down.
If not him, Garnett Smith, because he was just a character when he got here. So those guys, I'd like to see how they're doing. And then, you know, some of the guys, I just want to, you know, some guys I've seen here and there, or at least I'm able to keep up with on social media some, but I would still just like to hear more about what they're doing. Michael and Brian Arakpo have both opened up a business here in Austin where, they're selling cupcakes, you know? So it's pretty cool to see guys with families and just growing up and venturing out and doing different things. So
my last question, because I don't even know.
We're probably over.
I have no idea. I think we're okay, but I've been having we're like right where we're going to be. Who's the most full on dad of all the guys? Like now,
oh man,
they're just like, they used to be the athlete, the big man on campus, but now they're just dad.
I mean, Rack is still playing, but he has a little clan. I think he has three kids. I want to say DT has three or four. Matt Melton was a safety and was my college roommate. We roomed together even when we moved off campus, and he's fully embraced his dadum. So they have a young daughter, he and his wife, Maya. They have a young daughter and they actually brought her to the game, and he had the dad vest, you know, where
gone full on.
Oh
dad.
Yeah. He had the dad vest where she's sitting there in his chest, and about halfway through the first quarter, and it was his birthday this past week. So they were in town kind of celebrating his birthday, but it's different than how we used to, you know, he used to come into town and we would go and cut up. Now he comes into town and wife and kid are in tow. And he was telling me how, His wife, he had her go to the spa for about an hour, and he was just hoping that, like, you know, his daughter didn't just completely lose it on him while she was gone. And about halfway through the first quarter, we had gotten past the first quarter, so it may have been halfway through the second, I see them come walking up the steps because their seats are pretty close to mine. And I'm like, she can't handle it anymore. She has her little pink earmuffs on to kind of protect her from the sound some. And he was like, well, she's hungry. So that's exit stage left. So I would, if I would say anyone to embrace
that. Like I feel Melton. Absolutely. That's fantastic.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So, I would have to put my money on him.
You got anything else or we?
That's all I got for this episode. Again, I appreciate everybody's feedback. You know, please continue to give it good and bad. Just let me know what you think. I saw one of the guys post something about, you know, some, I guess, of the lesser heralded players that are you going to get a podcast from them? And it just kind of made me chuckle like, oh, there's always one of those guys.
I didn't even think that was fair. there. I was like, wait a minute. Those dudes didn't even go to college, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think most of them made it, but, you know, I get it. You know, I always looked at myself as just doing my best to serve a good role on the team and playing my part. I certainly wasn't a superstar or anything, but I still think I have an interesting perspective to offer. So
no, that dude was out of line.
That was funny to me, man. That's one of those things where, you know, over the years I've kind of gotten used to stuff like that, just because, you know, not a whole lot of people go back and post, but it was always something that just kept me interested. And so I always, you know, found it a way to
connect
with people.
Real quick, you know who took that stuff way too serious? It was Michael Griffin.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So protective.
Oh, yeah. He was into that stuff.
He and I had a good relationship, but good enough that was not afraid to, like, talk to me in a way that most athletes don't talk to reporters.
Yeah.
And there was a practice. It was so emphatic, you might even remember it. Marcus got ran over by somebody in a spring game. Mm-hmm. Like, bad.
Yeah.
Like, just... Marcus was a good player, right. But this was like one of those moments where somebody else made a highlight play and Marcus had to be on the bad side of it. And like, I made like a joke about it and Michael never forgot it.
Oh yeah. No. Nah.
Never.
And especially if it was about his brother, he was protective. But I'll tell you, man, we used to sit up in study hall and we would read Orange Blood. So anybody that thinks guys aren't reading that stuff, anybody that thinks parents aren't, anybody that thinks probably coaches aren't, you're certainly mistaken, because that's something that we used to pay attention to, whether we should have or not.
He was,
you know,
like,
he
was like, let's talk about the report card.
Yeah.
You gave us a grade of this. Why don't you tell me why you think? And I'd like, he put me on the spot and I was talking about it. And then he was like, and then that thing you said about, and this was like 7 months old. Like Michael had long memories.
Mike has a memory, man.
I was like, you've been carrying that grudge around?
Mike holds grudges.
You could have brought that up a long time ago and got that out of the air. Yeah. I was like, man, you've been mad at me for seven months.
He's a good dude, though, but that's part of what helped him keep his edge, man. He had a long memory, for sure.
Absolutely. I'll be quiet.
No, you're good, man. That was really all I wanted to cover. Continue to give me feedback on this podcast, especially of guys you'd like to hear. Come on. I'm going to try and reach out to some guys and get some people to come on the show. Yeah, I'm going to get him. He'll be a good one. I got some guys in mind and, some different features I want to try and do. But, you know, again, just until next time, until the next whistle, this has been Marcus Myers. And thankful again for you, Jeff Ketchum, for being on the show.